A picture may well paint a thousand words, but the added dimension of the human voice can help distill truth to its essence, while the printed word offers another version of reality. Bringing all three art and life forms together in one place, as an installation called One Southwark currently does at the Menier Gallery on Southwark Street in southeast London, helps to shed light from different angles on the human condition. At the same time, it allows breathing space for past and present experiences, as well as casting an eye and opening an ear on unfolding or future things. Collectively, One Southwark captures a snapshot of life in one of London's most diverse boroughs. It doesn't claim to be a summary of all there is to say about a place that's home to more than 250,000 people, speaking more than 100 languages, but it does grant insight into some of the human stories that lie at the heart of its communities and are the threads in its tapestry. We can only bring you the voices in this programme. You'll have to visit the exhibition for the whole story. Then again, the pictures are better on radio.
I think the main reason why I agreed to do this is because my love of Southwark. This is where I was brought up, and I've seen lots of changes, and I love the place. Like, for now, I really think in this kind of era, it is about the diversity. When I was a kid, it was different. I first went to school in Bermondsey, and I was the first black child in that school, so it had its really good points. People were really curious, so I got invited to all the parties, and then you had one or two people who got really sort of jealous of that, but they really didn't know anything about black people, you know, in those days. Because I wanted to go to Collingwood, that's where my mum wanted, because I lived in Commercial Way, first of all. But our neighbours, there was two other black girls, and they were already there. And I think they just didn't want, like, three would have been too much.
Offer our capacity of human beings to do something better and something good. We came with a lot of expectations. Yes, with all that I know, with all that.
That's why I put my life.
I was born in Bermondsey. What we used to call Round Town, which basically is that road, Redriff Road, that goes round the back there. They used to call it a mud island, I think, because it was, years ago, it was really susceptible for flooding. You know, the Thames would come up and you'd all move upstairs. Not in every part, but, you know, obviously those next to the river. Everyone that knew either worked in the docks or were associated in some manner or another. Shipwrights, gear people, you know, who supply the ship's gear, provision merchants. So virtually everywhere, it was a huge... That was the place, that was the most centre. And most of us worked in there, either... Your dad was, my dad was a stevedore. My brothers, I had three brothers, were also stevedore. I started off as a stevedore, but not for long. I realised that I'd come out of the Royal Navy at that time after doing national service. And I came out, I had a duty in the Lulsa. And all this bending and shovelling, these jobs that I had, wasn't really conducive to being a stevedore. So I had the option of then becoming a tally clerk, which was basically a guy who checked the stuff on and off ships, counted it, etc., you know. And that's what I did. I went into that. When I came out of the docks, eventually, it was a chance for me to get... I always thought I could do well outside, and they made a voluntary redundancy scheme. Oh, I think you got about £1,500 at that time. Of course, it went up considerably later on. And I grabbed at the opportunity to go and find a job that I really liked. I'd gone there basically because you didn't really think that you were as educated as you were, really. I mean, there was guys on there, they were brilliant. But they were dockers. Because they were dockers, it meant, you know, they didn't really have a lot of brain. Or people thought that way, I think.
I've come onto this earth to spread my myself, be my knowledge, my personality, and try and... I'm leaving Southwark, and I have a solid memory, we always remember how we met there.
The father is the head of the family, but the mother is... real head of the family, because the family seems to come to her if they have questions to ask or, you know, something they want or something they want doing, and then the mother goes to the father.
Yeah, okay.
You know, they always start with the mother, though. I've got seven of my own, but that's a small family now. In my age of mothers, we'll say, they have 13, 14, 15 kids. Yeah. When we were on the road, the baby be born today and you'd be moved out tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock, dragged out on the road. So settled people doesn't understand that happens to travelling mothers, and I think it still happens today. But mine was to go back 20 or 30 years ago. Still happens today, which I find is terrible. So it is. It really is terrible. Getting dragged from pillar to post. I mean, just, we were all over the country, but we were getting dragged from pillar to post. When we came to Southwark, the first thing we done was to get in contact with the schools, but they didn't seem to want to know, like a lot of the schools, till yourself came on board. And then that's when we got all the travelling children into school. When we were on the unofficial sites, as I said, we were dragged here and dragged there. But when we got on these permanent sites, at least we had hot and cold water, we had showers, and we had the toilets. Where the children can get a proper shower before they go to school. If you've got appointments in the hospital, you can get a proper wash and clean before you go to see the doctors. That means everything. I mean, you went to the caravan, you'd bring in a bowl of water to wash yourself, but you weren't washed properly. Or the kids wasn't even. You try your best, but it wasn't real. Now you've got the showers, things like that, what every family needs. It's only basic things, though, but we need them. We need them. There's a lot of families that won't move into houses because you are cut off away. Where if any of my daughter's here needs a babysitter, they know granny is there to do it. If they need to go to the hospital, granny is there to do it. So that's the most important things, to be there with them. It's the family. It's the family. That's the most important thing that I've got out of life, is the family. I mean, we've uncles, nieces, nephews, they all come into it. People can't understand sometimes where you could have maybe 300 in the one family. There could be 300 people in the one family. So they could.
I mostly ladies and children and families come together.
Inspire young children to be positive.
The problem we're facing in the community at the moment is a generation scam. And I'm working on that at the moment. Break this barrier, it's a bit like
the relationship between the restrictions and
I think what poetry does for me, and it's something I've done from a long time ago, it helps me to express my feelings, yeah? And I think for most people, if you don't express that feeling, it's a heavy weight, and that can weigh you down, yeah? You got feelings about all kinds of things, and I think even if you go through psychiatry, people talk, it's good to talk it out, and that's what my poetry is about to me. I'll tell you, the first poem I ever wrote, I've got it here, and it's a poem about loneliness. It's about home, being homesick. It's about it's to do with loss in a certain way. And this was written in it's copyrighted in 1975, but it was actually written in 1973. And I'd come to the country. It's 3 years since I'd been to England, because I came here in 1970. And you know, you've left at the age 14, 15, you've left home. You've left a whole culture behind you, and a new culture, and the people that you that you grew up with and that you care about are so far away you can't you can't relate to them in a physical way. And so what we do in certain cases, like, so we try to forget. It's easier to forget. To remember, it's too painful. And so I came from school one day and I wrote this. It's called Remembering. It says, nameless faces line the corridors of my mind, where shadows stroll unperturbed and disturbed memories partially reveal themselves. Then in the halls of reflection, the mind plays on memories of joy like the winds on a bamboo flute. The spirits of yesterday perform, unrehearsed but ready, acting to perfection, rearranging scenes, juggling past realities, mixing emotions and causing anxiety. I'm reliving past experiences. I'm relieving ancient hidden emotions. I'm mopping up spent tears, eroding the pains which have accumulated over the years. I'm remembering.
They come back home. I
first
wish
of all, that you they
learn.
Only
it's a new year.
Come from
the landmark, Denmark Hill. Yes, so that's right. It's still called Tony's Corner Shop. They kept the name. That was just a broken-down wooden shack when I went there, and I over a period it got made into a proper little shop. It was very small, but I had loads of customers. I used to cheek them and insult them, and they came back for more. I had great fun there. I was attacked four times. The first time, they were very decent. It was four that came in, and one removed my glasses and hit me in the face, which I thought was very kind of him, because, I mean, he could have hit me in the face with my glasses on. But that was the only time. The other people that attacked me, the last time was on a Sunday morning, when a young fellow, I was busy with the putting the inserts in the papers, and I turned round and he hit me in the face with my glasses on, which I've got the mark to show it, and he said, give me the money, and I went round the counter and pressed the button, and I had a large alarm, and he just flew out the way. Sunday morning was a bad day for getting hit.
I just look at the glasses full of water, not the empty sight. You know.
Well, thanks to me and you,
spent some of my formative years just outside London in Kent, and I used to ride a horse, and I used to look over the hedges and see London in the distance. And then at night, sometimes we'd sleep out in the garden and we'd see the orange glow of London in the distance. But we lived this idyllic lifestyle in the country, but within arm's reach of London. So now things are reversed. I'm living in London, but I need my countryside. I think I'd go mad if I didn't have it. I just grow things everywhere. I've got a garden and it's just packed with plants. The only thing I don't do very well with is houseplants. I've lived in Southwark for years now, different places. I've moved around the borough, but for the past 8 years I've been living in Peckham near Burgess Park. And it's an amazing space. It's a complete wilderness. You can just see little bits of the city poking up above the tree line. If you can cut those out, you're pretty much in a complete wilderness. It's full of wildlife, flocks of birds, foxes, huge rats, very happy rats basking in the sun. There's a horse, there's a few people, but lots of birds. You get people going in and harvesting wild food. So I've started on elderflowers this year, and I've made elderflower cordial. I see old Chinese ladies going in and picking medicinal herbs, digging up roots. I don't know whether it's allowed, but why not? It's just great fun down there, and it's an amazing open space and a complete antidote to urban living. So that's one direction I go in. Then I go in the other direction up towards Nunhead, where I've got two allotments, and I'm a bit of a mad veg grower. I've been doing it for about 12 years now. And I've had one very wild allotment, which for me was a bit of a slash and burn operation without the burn. It was pretty wild. I'd go in with my machete, clear a patch, plant a few things. I've got a bit more sensible now in my old age, so I actually grow things in rows now and do it a bit more formally and actually grow things that I can use. So the existing one's taken off, and I've now taken on another one. So double work. I'm completely into it. I spend hours up there. It's a little piece of Mediterranean hillside. It's just rocks and stones. It's full sun. Herbs love it. Lettuces hate it.
You know, they make 20,000 pounds.
Really? Well,
although we moved out of Bermondsey, in the first instance, it's under the slum clearance scheme, where they pulled all the old Victorian-type houses down. And then we all moved into places where there were bathrooms and places like that, where the local council and the London County Council had built. And it was really a change of lifestyle for us. Here it was, we all started having nice pieces of furniture, and suddenly home started to mean a little bit more than somewhere to bed down. But when we eventually moved in and bought our own house, as things got better, we moved down, in my case, to Wellington Sidcup. Although I've been here since 1999, I don't really consider that I'd ever be described as a man of Kent or an old Wellingtonian. I still have my own heart, a Bermondsey boy. I'm not on my own. There's quite a number of people down here with me. They say, where do you come from? They say, Bermondsey. Or Rotherhithe, you know, which basically we talk about the same places. And they still, I mean, I still get the Southwark News, and I wouldn't dream of getting a local paper. It doesn't mean nothing to me. The Southwark News loads about Millwall and little bits of where we used to know. If you were somewhere to refer back to, really, look back, you know, with a little bit of humour at times and a bit of sadness too.
Going too far down that road, fortunately. And a lot of people from Lambeth,
you talk about my
from Victoria,
yeah, I could tell you about my
boroughs, have actually moved,
which wasn't very successful.
When I was in Somalia, I finished in Chicago School, then I continued to use the
I'd like to start at the beginning and describe a little bit about what the area was like when I was growing up. I was born in St Giles's Hospital in Camberwell and grew up on a council estate in Peckham in the 1960s and 70s. I went to Oliver Goldsmith Primary School on Peckham Road, which was situated right next to the block of flats that I lived in. And the council estate that I grew up on, Sow Gardens, was just like a big adventure playground. It was a really fantastic place to be as a young child in the 1960s. Oliver Goldsmith had this very kind of family-oriented way of doing things. So you felt like you were part of a family in that school. It was then quite culturally diverse, which was quite important in the way that, in my outlook on life. But growing up on a council estate like Sow Gardens in the 1960s was fantastic because you had trees. It was before they cut all the trees down. So we used to call them the woods, and we used to climb the trees. We used to play knockdown ginger in the flats and, you know, line up in the big corridors, one child per door, bang, 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 and then run for the lift. You know, we used to chuck balloons off the block that we lived in. We lived in a smaller sort of block of about five stories. We used to play Tin Tan Tommy, where we would, you know, somebody would be it and you had to run into the block, and you'd hide in places like the chute, you know, where all the rubbish was. You wouldn't think of it now. If you saw it now, you'd think, why that? But you used to do it so you wouldn't get caught. And it was just a wonderful sense of freedom. You could walk to the shops on the other side of the estate and buy your mum a loaf of bread without any fear of being knifed or abducted or subjected to something horrible. It was quite, it felt safe, but it was within that boundary. And so looking back on that particular decade, and it was a very exciting decade to be growing up in with all that was happening in the world. I've always said that as a child, a young child, I could be watching Valerie Singleton making something out of sticky back plastic on Blue Peter 1 minute, and then within the next 20 minutes watching the horrors of the Vietnam War on the BBC News at 6 o'clock. It was that extreme, and at the age of 8 or 9 years of age, you could be exposed to that. And so it was a very rich, kind of fascinating period in which to be a young child.
Vibrant.
Am I you quiet to
and
yeah,
I would think I would tell a little alien spaceship man.
It's a shame when you see
that is a big change. Thank God that our children can go from the nursery to primary into secondary school, and then go on. So a lot of them is going out to college. So that is one. I think to me, it's marvellous. It is marvellous. God knows, it's marvellous. Sort of. To have the children doing that. Because we're no different than anybody else, really. We just prefer to live in a trailer where people prefer to live in a house. People didn't know us. So I suppose maybe it takes a while to get to know people. But we pet little bums trying to top for our caravans. So we did. And that was, I mean, we didn't do anything to anybody, but to have that done, just because we were travellers, we had, because we lived in the caravans, we had that done. And I think that's terrible. Even the supermarkets, after coming here, they used to bar us. They wouldn't let us in. Mm. The pubs wouldn't let you in. Mm. You can, with any advisor, any time they want to go to a drink, they can go to any of them pubs now. Mm. And it doesn't really matter. Mm. They can go to any of them pubs. But there was a couple of pubs around here even had no travellers, no dogs.
Mm, horrible.
No, that was, I mean, discriminating. Mm. That was terrible altogether. Mm. But as I said, as the time goes on, the people get to know them and we're as normal as the next and we're all human beings. And travelling families hurt the same as other people hurt. Mm. Do you know, we have deaths in our families. We have, you know, children getting sick. Do you know, I think that the same thing happens to the settled people, happens to us. Mm. There's no difference. Mm. We feel pain the same as them. Our children's born the same way as they're born. There's no difference. To me, there's no difference. Only we decide to live in a caravan. We're most happier and our family is right beside us to help them along. But as the time went down and the years went down, I mean, we're 22 year now in Southwick. Mm. There's not many people that doesn't know the travelling people here. Mm. There's loads of settled children comes in here with our children. They come down here the weekend to go swimming, to go to the parks. And it is grand, it's wonderful. To see that happening with travelling children. Do you know what I'm saying? Travelling is grand. So it is. It really is.
I owe it to you. I mean, I would to show it to you, you
to somewhere you a bit different, a bit the nicer, but I'd like to
hide it in the back.
Well, I think it was. You had because of the nature of the ships, and largely there were a lot of Commonwealth countries. You did have Chinese crews coming here, Lascars as we called them, you know, from India, places like that. And, you know, from the West Indies, banana boats used to come here. And inevitably, just like any overseas group here, I'm not talking about since the mass emigration, but this is like a gradual, where people met a local girl or decided that they stay here. And people, you know, I went to school, black people weren't, didn't see too many about. There used to be the odd one who'd married, perhaps you know, a local girl on his day, and no one took no notice of him. But when I say no notice of him, I mean, I didn't think it unusual. They accepted for what it is because he spoke with the same accent as you, he did, and he lived next door to you, and he actually really adapted to the customs of that particular time in Bermondsey. So he was accepted. And I suppose natural progression of things, you know, they wind up getting married. It was not a great deal. I wouldn't say that. I mean, I could go down and I'd know foreigners, well, say foreigners, non-Britons, if you like, at that time, and living down those streets. But you occasionally see one. You occasionally see the guy of an Indian with a Sikh, with a turban. But he was invariably going around public houses with ties in a suitcase, which he'd be offering, you know, for sale, half a crown each or whatever it was at that time. So you see the Sikh. They were unusual people. Indian toffee they used to sell. And that was an Indian toffee. It was a type of candy floss. That's like, it's strange, because I can remember as a kid, it seemed like, almost like years ago when they used to have a bus ticket, they used to punch a ticket. And but this was dug around his neck, and he used to wind a little handle, and out used to come this, what we called it, Indian toffee, but it was a type of candy floss.
As many places we noted from that are really bad. The North South East,
what do you like about
that?
I'm known to say I'm an English resident.
Well, I came from Trinidad and Tobago in the Caribbean. I came here in the 1970s. And what I think of rivers, I think of hills, I think of fruits and fruit trees. I think of the friends I grew up with. I think of my grandmother and my brother and sister I left at home. I think of school, of the school I went to, because the school has always been an important part of my life. And the person who actually got me into poetry and taught me the power of words happened to be a teacher of mine, a woman by the name of Merle Hodge. She wrote a book called crick-crack monkey. But we grew up at a time when there was the so-called Black Power Revolution in Trinidad and Tobago, when the whole status quo was changing, where you had a situation where you had to be either white, mixed race, or light-skinned to be anywhere up in the echelons of society. And I suppose it's the hangover of slavery. And we had a situation where we had an independent country, and things were changing. And Merle Hodge was my literature teacher. And she read a couple of poems which actually changed my whole way of thinking, because before we were doing things with Henry Wordsworth Longfellow and that sort of thing, some people were talking about daffodils. And she brought some poetry that was real. She had a poem called The Antebellum Sermon, and it's about a burial of a black guy in slavery who had been lynched, and his people were about to bury him. But as a slave, you can't challenge a situation openly. And so he used the Bible to preach revolution. And it's a powerful thing. And another one was by, it sounds terrible now, because it's called the... it says, what happens to a dream deferred, a raisin in the sun? Does it fester like a sun run, or does it wrinkle like a raisin in the sun? And that, to me, those are the most two powerful poems I'd read at that time. And that taught me the power of words, how you can actually use words to change things, to change people's attitudes. You can have a dictionary in front of us, and then depending on how we structure them words, we can have different meanings, we can have a different effect.
Caddy goes to my husband and my son.
First of all, I'd like to ask you why you agreed to be in
Here. I've got friends, I've got family,
or why do I agree to be gardens,
allotments, fruit trees, the oil, and rats and whatever around. Now we realise that the disease you get.
I think the main reason...
When I was in hospital at Guildford, I was on the balcony. It was in the open air, but it had a glass cover on the top. And I had a little radio there, and I was out there on the balcony because I was in the hospital for a long time. I think I told you it was months and months in the hospital. And it was in a quadrangle, and I heard this music coming from a little lower down where the quadrangle was, and I couldn't believe it. I thought, that's absolutely... It was the Allegro molto vivace movement of Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony, the third movement. And when I heard it, I thought, that's the most incredible sound I've ever heard. And I still think it's the most incredible sound. The lum dum da dum dum da da dum da dum dum da dum dum da dum da dum dum da dum dum da. Da 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 da. Crash! Mother! Exhilarating, and I couldn't believe it. And from that moment, I was sold on classical music.
You have to be positive to yourself to get the positive from
people with disabilities.
So that's why I see
of
a close community.
Then when I left school at 16, I went into another hospital.
And coffee are very clean and beautiful place. I live because the situation there was getting worse.
The name of an angel.
I had a very happy and fulfilling childhood. My teenage years were the complete flip side of that. Complete opposite. From the day I walked into the secondary modern school that I went to in 1969, I was very young, I was only 11 years old, and it was a real rude awakening because it was a hard school. It was a mixed school, it was boys and girls, but it was a tough place to be if you were a sensitive kid. And I was also becoming aware in my early teenage years that I was gay, and of course, you know, that was something that was just not talked about. So there was no way I could express myself, even though I was singled out as the class puff, as they called me, because of my sensitivity, because I always had my nose in a book and didn't want to do sport. I was kind of stereotyped in that way and bullied sometimes it was mostly verbal bullying, but there was occasional physical bullying, and it was, and from the teachers as well. The teachers were just as bad, or some of them were just as awful, and it was a very unhappy and very soul-destroying experience. It's a complete and utter waste of time. So what I used to do to avoid this awful situation, particularly the bullying, which made me very unhappy and very isolated and very introverted, I used to just bunk off. So I'd go and visit relatives, I'd go and visit cinemas in the West End, I'd spend whole afternoons with my hard-earned pocket money. I had a Saturday job, so I had some money, you know, of my own to go and go to the bookshops in the West End and look, buy books and go to the cinema. It was a very lonely kind of experience. But it did mean that when I did leave school at the age of 16 with no qualifications, that I was out on my own in the big wide world with nothing, no confidence, no qualifications, nothing. But roll on 30 years, I did eventually, in my late 20s, graduate from college with a Bachelor of Arts degree in film and television. That did give me a lot of confidence and opened some doors. And more recently, I did graduate again from university with a Master of Philosophy degree. So I'm now Stephen Bourne, M.Phil, and I don't even know what philosophy is, but I've got a master's in it, so
I've been an estate agent, so I've tried to not be.
I ask my kids,
travelling woman and a travelling
mother. We came here first time, it's so difficult.
Crucified with the red roots and parking restrictions, and we've just driven out.
I cannot deny it. I like Colombian music, I like Colombian food, I like to see the landscapes. It still reminds my city, my countries.
Going to school. I says, I'm sending you a good vibe.
Going too far down that road.
And I'm listening to
the and I've seen it in work hard.
Showing it with blessing.
A couple of my ideas, they wasn't doing the way I wanted.
Very, very.
So
been
I just
chose
to set up my own association.
I could reel them off, but I can't anymore because I can't remember. That's a trouble. My mind is beginning to go backwards. I'm not remembering things. Things I could reel off just like that, and now I can't. I've been to the doctors. They've examined me. I tell you, the first doctor said, have you made your will? The second doctor said, it'd be kindness to have you put down. I mean, you know, it's just wasting their time. I mean, I'm getting worse and worse. I forget all the time. It's so difficult now. I mean, I just forget things. I mean, I do the most stupidest things that you can't believe. Just whack my finger, closing that door there, because I went bang like that and forgot to take my finger out the way. What can you do about that? It's all too terrible for words. Everybody tells me, oh, everybody's like that, but they're not. I've just seemed to be getting worse and worse. What can you do?
And I actually worked at a stop station quite a time. My passion was butchering.
I feel that's what I struggle with, my walk in the park, my first day at nursery. Reason being why I personally remember it is because I used to have a phobia and I used to be scared of clowns. And a big clown came into the nursery when I was there playing in the playground, and I panicked and I ran to the teacher and I grabbed her leg and I wouldn't let go for the whole day, and she didn't understand. And she had to call my mum. And when my mum came, my mum explained to her, no, she's terrified of clowns. And she was like, oh, because the clown came today. Which was, it's not a great memory, but, you know, that's probably more of a reason why I do remember it. That's dramatic. No, I do remember that. You actually just triggered that. It's quite embarrassing now. I used to actually be really scared of clowns.
Well, it didn't, because
being with family and
that
friends,
and your partners,
I can definitely say I'm in love at the moment, and I'm happy.
It's
just across the road, actually, in the registration office.
Hello? Hello? Oh, who's speaking? Okay, damn. Listen, I'm in an interview right now.
Call me back in an hour's time, please. Okay, thank you, Dad. Yeah, and where was I? My wife was, my wife grew up in, my wife was a nurse. My wife, B, was a general nurse, a psychiatric nurse, a midwife, and she became the equal access manager to Guy's NHS Trust. She died in 1995, and that was the turning point in my life, really. I actually walked out of a job with Camden Council at the time, 2 years later. When it's another thing we need to pay close attention to. Loss, it's very difficult to deal with loss. And it's very difficult, not for the person who's actually lost, it's also very difficult for the people around them. Yeah? Because some people don't know how to deal with that. They don't know how to react to you, how to respond to you. They don't know what you're going through, and so they distance themselves from it. And that's important, because the people you're expecting to be supportive, they can't be, because they can't understand. So while at first you may be very angry at people, you know, you didn't support me at that time, it's because they don't know how to. If they knew how to support you, they would. But like I said, my first loss was to deal with being away from home, because being taken away from your familiar things is a loss. Then came the loss of my wife. Then my mom died not too long. My mom's a beautiful woman. And it's amazing the way one loss can affect your whole life. Loss of my wife affected every other relationship I've had after that. And it's imperative that when you suffer a loss, that you start dealing with that at that particular moment. Because I remember when my wife died, I presented an image of everything's okay, because I didn't even want to deal with it. But 2 years later, I walked into a job, into my workplace, and somebody mentioned my wife, my manager at the time, and I just took off on him. And that's, you know, he says, okay, I think you need a rest. And that was the last time I went to work. And, you know, you try to recover, and you can recover so far, and then you drop back down again. Okay, so I've dealt with it to a certain extent right now, and I hope it's making me a bit stronger. But within that time till now, it's affected a whole lot of other relationships, in that it's very difficult for your partner to, or your present partner to live in the shadow of a dead person.
You are a good person. You concentrate. You put
sometimes
your effort
in something.
Sometimes
the maintenance isn't very good.
Kind of
you kind of think
definitely
with a little
can
bit
say
more
there
effort.
Is a difference.
And we have
an
respect
going out
with each other.
So I think
the friends
we
have
just need
totally respect from your own
people's real
the friends,
care,
the youngest
attention.
Brothers.
As we're looking now from out from Deptford Wharf, we look right on the river frontage. And of course, you look out now with a certain degree of sadness, and you just see the occasional pleasure boat move up and down the river. But you've not, it doesn't seem that many. It seems like yesterday when you'd look out there and you'd see boats well laden going up to the Surrey Docks on the high tide, or you were up to the Pool of London. And alongside all this, along the river, was the wharves. Each individual wharf usually specialised in maybe certain commodities. You know, some would do tea, or some would be coffees, some of them would be nuts and canned goods from all parts of the world. And the lighters used to come up, had been loaded into the ship, off the ship, I should say, into the lighter. And then the lighters themselves would come alongside the wharf and they'd unload it there.
Odd question.
No, fair. Okay, I know there is some
disability.
We rely on our expertise. I think if you are where you come from, you are who your parents are, that kind of thing.
I had the greatest fortune to meet a girl. I first saw her outside the synagogue. Her name was Joy. Joycine Joy. Ultimately, she was the only girl that I ever went out with. I never went out with any other girl. She was absolutely wonderful in every respect. The most wonderful person. It was my greatest fortune in this world. We moved apart for a certain time. Then one day I met her at the synagogue, and it was a dance, and they were playing a tune. take me to your heart again. And she sang with it, with a tear in her eye, take me to your heart again, because we had parted. And I followed her instructions and I took her to my heart again. I think she was more worthy of someone even better than me, because she was so the most wonderful, wonderful girl, wonderful woman you could ever come across. She was absolutely perfect in every detail. Well, if you look over there, you'll see what the rabbi said about her when he gave the eulogy to her, yes. She died on the 25th of July, 2005. And I thought, well, I've got to say something at the end of the stone setting when the rabbi and everybody had, all the things had been done. And so I said, I read of a man who stood to speak at the stone setting of a friend. He referred to the dates on her tombstone from the beginning to the end. He first noted the date of her birth, then spoke the following date with tears. But he said what mattered most of all was the dash between those years, for that dash represents all the time that she spent alive on earth. And only those who knew her know what that little dash was worth. For it matters not how much you own, the cars, the house, the cash. What matters is how you live and love, and how you spend your dash. So now, as we remember dear Joycine's life and give thanks for the times we shared, we're glad that we were part of her dash that sits between her years.
You've been listening to various voices from a project called One Southwark, capturing snapshots of life in one of London's most diverse boroughs, offering insight into some of the human stories that lie at the heart of its communities and are the threads in its tapestry. One Southwark combines elements of sound, photography and the printed word in an exhibition that's currently running at the Menier Gallery in Southwark Street in southeast London. It's open each day until and including Saturday, June 20th from 10 until 6, and admission is free. One Southwark has been developed by Southwark Council's Community Involvement and Development Unit in partnership with Rehan Jamil, photographer, and London's arts radio station, Resonance 104.4 FM. We're very grateful to those who so generously shared their stories in this project and to those who sourced and recorded them. Julia Honnes, Dax Ashworth, Dave Cannon, Nick Hamilton, and myself, Michael Clear.